I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
How can we make sure that corporations put sustainability first? In this episode, we're speaking with Theodore Kogianu, an associate professor at the University of Edinburgh who works at the intersection of sustainability, data science, and finance. We ask Theo to explain the world of sustainable finance and what needs to change to make our planet's health the bottom line for business. Take a listen.
So thank you very much for having me on. My name is Theodore Kogianu. I'm an associate professor in sustainable finance at the University of Edinburgh. I also have the immense privilege to serve on the EU Platform on Sustainable Finance, which is an advisory body to the EU Commission working on sustainable finance legislation. Originally, if I look at my CV, it doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't make sense to everyone. I'm originally trained as an electrical engineer. I started off with a not necessarily naive, but I would say narrow-minded view that, oh, if you had the technology, you would solve everyone's problems, right? But we were learning that solar costs were going down, that we had the technology, that in principle, we know how to, you know, sort out the grid and so on. Of course, there are still some things that we need to work out. But, you know, when it came to solving climate change, we kind of had the technology figured out. And when I heard the excuses, at least in my student days, of why aren't we doing it much, it was always political will. It was always finance wasn't flowing. It was, yeah, always that, you know, we can't get the, you know, match again the financial flow with a level of granularity with the technical solution that we were looking for. And that's what got me to switch from being kind of just focused as, you know, an electrical engineer, kind of in a dark basement, also somewhere in Edinburgh, looking at the electronic circuits, to then say there's a bigger world. And so, yeah, I suppose my journey wasn't necessarily as, it wasn't linear, and it evolved a lot from, I suppose, engineering to finance to then data science and now policy, kind of sustainable finance policy. And yeah, happy to discuss about how these come together.
What a robust background, and perfect for us, really. I think we really appreciate the journey from trying to solve problems from a technical perspective. I mean, Stephanie's an architect and I'm an engineer, and arriving to the point where you say, wait, I can't solve this unless the money flows with it. And that's really at the basis of everything we talk about, is that economic motivation to solve these problems. And whether it's through monetary policy or through finance or business models, it all comes down to how do we figure those questions out. But maybe you could, for our listeners, explain a little bit what you mean by sustainable finance, and what really do you dig into when you talk about that field?
Sure, it's a really great question. And the first part, I think, is what is sustainable, right? I think we need to pretty much put that down. And it depends on the objective that you have. You know, when you're trying to solve climate change versus the way you would try to tackle air pollution or biodiversity or, you know, waste and so on, these are quite different in the way we should go about them. Their whole distribution on, you know, even as you said, their economic value chains are very different. Their financial flows are very different. So let's take climate change, for example, right? What is sustainable for the climate? And so we have, right, all the science behind us, which tells us that, okay, if we want to avoid the dangerous consequences of climate change, we have the 1.5 degree net zero target by 2050. And that's what we're working towards, right? And so if you take then this science and then try to, okay, how do I then look at my economic activities, at my sectors, at my companies, at my cities? What do they all need to do to align with this net zero goal? So if you understand that trajectory towards net zero greenhouse gas emissions, for example, then you can overlay on top of the science, you overlay the financial instruments, and then you start to understand that, hey, for a big corporation, I know it's financed mostly by loans from investment banks and bonds that they issue on large capital markets. We also know, for example, everyone is talking about the divestment movement, right? Divesting, for example, from the equities of a company, but that these shares usually are already fundraised for. You know, we've already pumped money into a company whenever there was an initial public offering or when they issued additional equities. But most of the time, these are called secondary markets, right? It's just investors trading ownership rights with each other. So sustainable finance is really an understanding of a sustainable objective and the science behind it. And how do I marry that with financial markets and financial market outcomes, of understanding of how finance flows, but also the conditions that come with the flow of finance to really deliver real economy, real sustainable economy outcomes. And that's really hard to do, because there are a lot of, and this is what I think it's crucial, and I'd love to talk about with you, is that we have a lot of conflicts of interest in trying to solve both sides, you know, the sustainable part, but also the financial part. And sometimes they, you know, when you're trying to marry the two together, you realize that you have huge conflicts of interest that, you know, sustainable finance, really, is it sustainable, or how do we get there? Yeah.
Maybe you could provide us an example of such a conflict, like the flow of money, the way investments occur is sometimes elusive to people who are not in that industry, right? How the larger picture works. Could you give us an example for perhaps of a company that's looking for an investment and why that conflict of interest shows up?
Sure. So whenever a company or whatever type of structure is looking for money, it's pretty much like a dating game, right? You're trying to get a match, and that match is an investor. You're trying to convince investors that not only now you're financially viable in your project, your company, and you're going to give a good return, but now that you're also delivering environmental or social benefits through your actions, right? So you now have two objective functions. It's not, it used to be that, you know, as long as your financials looked reasonable, you could make a decent case and you got the investment. But now you have to say, actually, I'm doing so much good for society. And also, you know, as we have in dating, also perhaps more like online dating, right? You can get catfished pretty easily as a, as an investor. And this is where the part, you know, around greenwashing comes in. We have an incentive, or by the nature of financial markets, you have incentives where companies are looking to make themselves look a bit better than they actually are, because, of course, investors now value that. And if you don't have really robust monitoring systems to ensure that that environmental social performance is actually delivered, then you can claim pretty much anything, right, with no follow-up. And that has been a big problem. You know, right now you have very sparse reporting at the company level about their, for example, climate change performance, and you don't really know what's going on in the black box, although we are getting better.
So what's the conflict of interest?
So I suppose, yeah, so it's a good point. That's where we started from. So for example, with investment banks, perhaps this is the where the conflict of interest is most poignant and most visible, in that an investment bank would help a company go, you know, and raise funds from investors, right? But on the other hand, they would also advise investors to say, these are, you know, investment opportunities and this is what you should look at. So when that happens, you know that, for example, investment banks are incentivized to side with companies because they are paid mostly, their fees are mostly paid by companies. So a lot of, I suppose, the brokers in the space don't really have the incentive to say, Well, actually, sorry, my company isn't that good of an investment. The company that I'm marketing to you isn't that a great investment from an environmental perspective. They might look great financially because, you know, it is unlikely that we have environmental regulation. But in all honesty, you know, we don't think you should, you know, said no investment bank ever, right? So in a way, the conflict of interest stems from the fact that if your fees are coming from those who are incentivized to look better, you as an actor in the economy cannot necessarily speak truthfully because it'll damage your own kind of financial stance.
I mean, for me, the conflict is really kind of short-term payoff versus long-term payoff, right? If you're environmentally sustainable and profitable, a long-term payoff is going to happen. But if you're profitable but not environmentally sustainable, you might get a big short-term gain financially, but long-term, you're going to kill yourself off because of climate change. So is there emerging a set of metrics that people can follow when they're investing in a company, or is that just kind of the green labeling or greenwashing that comes out? And what are you as a sustainable finance expert doing in the field of developing those metrics or you know, shaping that new conversation to address those conflicts?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and I think the industry now, there's a lot of metrics that have emerged, but particularly in the investment space. And metrics have to do with the actual performance or the ground truth. So, for example, I can look at the carbon emission trajectory, right? What the company produces itself, or whether, you know, the company buys electricity and then that's, you know, outside their scope, or the carbon emissions associated with their goods and services upstream and downstream. So you can build based on mostly, and again, self-reported data by the companies themselves, right? You could build some of these metrics. And again, key is self-reporting by the company, which is a lot of, again, the incentive in a lot of these numbers is to perhaps minimize some of these figures. So a lot of the data that we might have now might be underestimated. The issue is that when companies go out and fundraise, they don't only fundraise based on these metrics. In fact, these metrics are actually rarely in the spotlight, right? They would give us a lot of big claims, right, about net zero neutrality and about all of these big plans, which aren't necessarily yet substantiated by their CapEx figures, nor by their historical recent performance. And so what we're trying to do now more as researchers, we have an initiative called Greenwatch.ai, is to collect the statements of the CEOs and senior executives of companies worldwide and understand how bold they are with respect to their vision around climate change, and then try to look then at the ground truth, which is their actual CapEx on green initiatives and their recent carbon performance, or actually the carbon performance after they've made these claims, right? So if you say you're the most sustainable company in the world already, and then your next year carbon performance shows that your emissions are going up substantially, then we should take these with a grain of salt. So we're using the tools that we have available to hopefully just draw the attention on these inconsistencies between, you know, what we say and what we do.
Yeah, the conflict of interest, I'm actually really intrigued, because sometimes I think, like, how can we in 2022 still have a conflict of interest where we actually know that climate change is already here? You know, there is no way we can avoid those consequences. We are living with climate change. It's getting worse the more time we spend doing basically nothing. Or, you know, there are efforts, the circular economy, for example, but we know it has only slowed down, you know, and really the root cause of all of this is growth, right? There is, and we know the limits of growth. It's not that we don't know it, right? And we people know it. I think governments actually know because there are people in governments, you know, it's, people are in companies. I think we are intelligent enough to actually know that we cannot spend more what we have. And we have definitely exceeded our natural resources. We're going beyond our limits. And so how can there still be a conflict of interest? You know, it's like if Earth is dead, there is no business. I mean, how simple can it get? you know, so... so I would just wonder, like, are we like sustainable finance? Shall we not just switch into this new kind of degrowth machine, or would it be a better like foundation to start with, and rather than negotiating the conflict of interests?
I think, in principle, at the societal level, everyone agrees. Even lobbyists would very much nod. Yes, right. The problem is. When your paycheck really depends on you not speaking up and against lobbying against the climate, if that is your paycheck, is really hard to walk away from it. And that's what a lot of people don't do it because, you know, there's a lot of people that agree and they would say, yes, please put the recycling facilities there. Please, yes, just make all of my... you know, electricity green, you know, I just wake up in the morning and push a button. I never think about, you know, is this electricity green? Like we just go about our day, right? Yeah, I think we have an issue in that there's, you know, a lot of the paychecks of a lot of people still depend on the fossil fuel industry. So, and at the level of, you know, when we were talking about building back after COVID-19, you know, there's always this idea that, yes, we have to protect the people and phase out the business model, right? It's the narrative also in the just transition. We need to make sure that, you know, you can't just take people's jobs away. And again, a lot of politicians would be very uneasy to say pulling the plug on fossil fuels because, you know, their voters will be directly affected. There are solutions to, you know, ensure continuity of income of you know, of people and so on. But a lot of these people, they're not necessarily those who are in the coal mine and working. You know, we are talking top level management, very strong lobby. You know, these are not the everyday necessarily people who, you know, work necessarily in oil and gas. Although, you know, it would help if more, you know, more of them would be able to walk away from the industry and you know, cause a bit of a talent shortage. But ultimately, we're talking about, I think, very high level, you know, incredibly smart people, executives, which are paid millions of dollars that still work in the industry that just lobby against it. And we have this reality. If anyone has seen the ExxonMobil lobby, you know, which was unveiled through the Greenpeace, investigative report to show all of these tactics, we still have a lot of people that are fighting against it because of, you know, the ultimate economic interest and again, conflict of interest. So I would agree with you, Stephanie, at the kind of the big level, you know, yes, everyone understands this, but at the, you know, when it comes to making a decision at the individual level, you know, you look at this and say, well, not yet.
Yeah, I think the slogan was actually build back better. And I was wondering what that better, you know, like really better than we already have. No, I'm just kidding. Let's decide on the course where we're taking this episode.
This conflict, I mean, I don't think it's such a hard thing to understand that, you know, we all have to stop burning fossil fuels, but you win more money if you stop last as opposed to if you stop first. So we all know it, right? We all know we should stop, but in the kind of game theory, you know, if you can have everyone else stop before you stop, you're better off, right? And so I think there's a lot of gaming going on, trying to be not be the initiators, but fake it so that you can get the investment, but you're still reaping the benefits of the profitability of fossil fuels. I mean, I think that is the conundrum we face, and adding metrics like you're talking about for investments and giving more data, more information is very important. But in the end, somehow we've got to create a new business model that actually makes it profitable to, or actually more attractive to be sustainable. And I guess the question is, does that require, from your perspective, Theo, huge government investment in the kind of solar technologies or wind technologies such that they just become kind of the default, de facto, cheapest way to do business? Or does it mean really shifting these markets in a way that we quite, can't quite figure out how to do? But, you know, what's the priority for us as policymakers to create sustainable finance, in your opinion?
I mean, it starts with a very basic, even with a very basic thing, so much as accepting the science. So in Europe, you would be probably laughing, but, you know, we had quite a few governments in Eastern Europe, as well as France, pushing very hard for natural gas to be considered as green under the green taxonomy. So this is supposed to be the label, the gold standard of what sustainable technologies should be in, right? And this is, you know, we had the science, we had the technical expert groups telling us, and again, it's not about gas, it's just about a sensible carbon emissions threshold, which is 100 grams of CO2e per kilowatt hour. If you take that threshold, you know, you're not discriminating against gas. It's just that gas doesn't make it. You know, if we can find a way to use gas that passes that threshold, gas is in. It's just that it's out based on that threshold. And so, you know, we had a lot of politicians being then involved in what should be a very technical decision-making process in saying, look, the gold standard of what sustainable is, you know, this is the benchmark. Then economies can decide, politicians, countries themselves can decide what to do with it. You know, you can just not invest in it. You know, there's no one penalizing you that you're not investing in renewable energy. But, you know, at least you have a truthful benchmark. but we're still at the level where even the benchmarks, you know, we're still, from a societal perspective, again, coming back to the conflict of interest, we still have this debate of, okay, what is the good benchmark? So I think to me, it's whenever we have policy making decisions or all sorts of people that decide for the collective, I think having transparent governance processes where, again, we were talking about this conflict of interest, where the industry doesn't make the rules for itself, where we make sure that we have financial independence of a lot of people who are at the table. Like, I think people should know what, you know, in principle, at least those who consider themselves slightly or claim to be independent, to also say, okay, what is really your economic interest? And we don't have that, right? We have a lot of people, a lot of claims that come from, you know, people and organizations that are, again, have an interest, which is not necessarily the societal interest. But I think we're getting much, much better of understanding what needs to be done. So if I can explain on the taxonomy side, it could be technical geeky, but we've changed quite a lot in the way we look at companies. So it used to be that when I asked the question, how green is General Electric, we didn't really know what do we mean by that? But now if we ask how is General Electric aligned, for example, with climate change, we can tell that story a bit better, because now we're not looking at the level of the company, we're looking at the level of economic activities within a company. So what do I mean by that? So we know General Electric is doing engines for planes, right? Okay, that's one part. But they also do all these MRI scanners. They do that as well. Then they also manufacture wind turbines, right? And so now we're encouraging companies to disclose their economic activities that they're involved in at a very detailed level, at least in Europe. We'll see if that catches on in the US and other parts of the world. But there are taxonomies around the world emerging on this model where we can slice these companies and understand, okay, you're doing a lot of stuff, particularly these big conglomerates. What is the part that is really sustainable in accordance to an environmental or social objectives that I care about? And we can start understanding this at a much, much better level. We can ring fence finance and say, here's money, but it doesn't go for, you know, your plane engines. It goes for your green economic activities. And, you know, you can start structuring these deals in a much more targeted way towards solutions. So we're making progress.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I've often thought, you have ESG, right? So environmental, social, governance. And even those, I might be able to invest in a company that's really good on environmental, but they compensate for that by not being so good on the governance or not being so good. So they may, you know, exercise a lot of corruption in order to achieve those sustainability goals because their bottom line, right, really doesn't pay attention to which goal you're trying to optimize. It's all about the cost cutting.
Absolutely. That's a great point. And I, you know, should have mentioned again on the taxonomy legislation is set up in a way that you have to deliver what's called a substantial contribution to climate. So you need to make sure that, for example, your wind farms are delivering or that your new buildings are energy efficient, right? But then you also need to make sure that it's called the do no significant harm principle. You do not do significant harm to biodiversity, to your water, to pollution, to circularity. And there's a third condition in the EU legislation where you have to abide to minimum social safeguards. So, you know, around child labor or product safety and so on. And so in order to be called really sustainable, it's not enough to just, yeah, be aligned with the climate goal and go towards net zero at the economic activity level, but you can't do damage. So for example, you know, when you're thinking about building, again, new building infrastructure, right? You have this huge development and it's, you know, incredibly energy efficient, right? You even put solar panels on it, it's self-contained, but you develop it in a protected area. You've destroyed your whole biodiversity. that doesn't work, right? And it's quite common sense, and most people know. It's like, yeah, no, you know, we can't do that. We cannot say we do sustainable mining and then destroy everything. You know, we have this huge holes in the ground all over the globe. That doesn't work. So there is an acknowledgement of that. That means that the data systems and the tests need to be much more granular for us to, you know, to be able to invest in these solutions. And again, we are getting there, but unfortunately it's, you know, we know that the challenge is, you know, 2050, 2060 is this generation. And yes, some of these developments are quite slow.
I think it's been a wonderful conversation with you, Theodore. And it's such an interesting and important conversation to have, right? Because in a way it's on the where it hurts, right? It's exactly where we should actually look at and discuss and elevate that conversation even more, because this is where our pain starts. You know, all the other stuff is just connected to it. That's how I feel about this. So it's been wonderful. Thank you so much for your time and being on our podcast.
Yeah, thank you. And also thank you for your interest. And I equally resonate. I think a lot of the solutions are at hand. It's just that we can't necessarily I think we do a lot of counterproductive things. You know, we go for a run and then we go to the fast food, you know, while we're on the run. And it's like, it just it's kind of this constant battle of why don't we have a six pack? Not that we should aim for it, I don't think, but, you know, even just being healthy, just having healthy exercise routine. We don't seem to be having that healthy exercise routine because we keep eating fast food while out on a run.
It's so much more convenient, isn't it?
Yeah. Saves time as well.
First of all, I think this topic is so important because we're not going to solve climate change if corporations are not directly at the forefront of that problem, of solving that problem.
Greenwashing is a big topic.
Greenwashing is basically saying, we're going to put a green label onto our cereal box, even though it's not really sustainable.
Right. Or on your car or on your heating system.
Right.
But what if the entire system wouldn't function anymore if by not cheating, it's kind of obvious that it doesn't work anymore, but then what if there is no alternative solution?
But it has to, I mean, maybe it's the fact that our system really actually doesn't work because it actually destroys the planet and a lot of other side effects that are not accounted for in our economic system. The way in which businesses make money doesn't work. So from my perspective, what we really need to do is change business models. How do we, and that means raising prices probably, and that means changing wages, and you know, the entire system has to scale up to account for the planet's needs. But the question is, how do we do that?
Yeah, you raise huge questions.
I do.
Huge questions.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Brought to you by Game Changers, www.gamechangers.world. For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.